What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and we've got the crew, Pete McKenzie.
Hey.
Kiara Mitchell.
Hello.
Gabby Magnuson.
What's up?
And Jake Delo.
Greetings.
So a few quick hits. It's so hard to down select the things to talk about and like the things to leave off the table because there's just only so much time. One disclaimer I have to offer up front, I realized that when I put this in the Slack chat, I forgot to put the link to it. But basically, a few days ago, I got some angry note from a stranger, which happens sometimes. And it said, was looking forward to your podcast, but it turns out you pretend to court both sides and are actually just a leftist. And
okay, dude.
So like I need to...
on a side note, we're looking for a white nationalist to join the pod. So
that's diversity. Yeah. This is why I can't embrace liberalism fully, because I can't go full circle to embrace the white nationalist. my tolerance has boundaries. So just to be super clear, if you listen to the show more than one episode in, you know what this is all about. Like, first of all, there's a fucking Marxist on the show and it's not me. So, like, if you think this is courting both sides, what the fuck is Jake doing here? Right?
There's a fucking Marxist here and it's not me. Yeah.
It's true. And, like, I am of the left, right? I'm not Marxist left, but, like, certainly left. The show is just... It is what it is, man. What I'm definitely, if you're conservative, I am happy to have you listen to the show. I am not looking for you. You're not our audience. Conservatives are overwhelmingly not Gen Z and millennials, and Gen Z and millennials is where this is. So if the show has a left lean, and it should, since we talk about literally quote unquote progressive foreign policy every episode, you can't miss it. What were you thinking that you thought this would be like? A bipartisan show. It's not a fucking bipartisan show. It's not, I'm not trying to like brand the show as overtly explicitly political, but I might have to avoid confusion. If you're a conservative who wandered into this show, welcome, but shut the fuck up. This is like, be open-minded and listen, but like, I'm not here to take your opinion or to pander to you, you fuck. I'm here to pander to people who are like us. So, because this is how we see the world, okay? So, I just want to like make that very clear, right?
That was remarkable. It's just like we could go through and deconstruct that. Everyone just be like, "Shut up, you fuck. Come here and be tolerant. Listen to me. I want to pander to someone else." Yeah. That was fucking awesome.
I wonder what it was that drew this person to the podcast, though. Like, if was it you? Does this guy have no idea, like, what your opinions on anything?
Yeah,
like,
I don't.
I completely don't understand. Yeah.
If you follow me on Twitter too, it's the same shit. Like the pod as the podcast, same on Twitter. Like I fucking am what I am. My truth to power happens to come out with like a pretty lefty slant. But I also own it. Like, it's not like I'm running away from it. So, like, I don't know what kind of mixed message am I sending that would make somebody think that I'm fucking... it's so weird. Maybe they saw, like, former Pentagon official and that's what they're deducing. I don't know.
It's also worth noting that, like, we definitely have left dispositions on this pot. But, I mean, that's not, like, an all-encompassing worldview. Like, I don't know. We're not Chapo. So, like... If you are a conservative listener and you want to suggest things to us, please do, because we genuinely do want to hear it. We do want to chat about it and yarn about it.
I mean, my thing is, like, we tend to come out on left positions, but it's generally from inquiring into something. It's not always first principles. On something like climate change, it's first principles. On something like, I don't know, not being a fucking rapist, it's first principles. But like in general, when we're considering like some issue, we're working through it, and we just come out on positions that are on the left side of the spectrum. So it's not like we're trying to have blinders on. It's just we also don't want false equivalency, you know.
We might not like claim to bridge the gap, but it's there's certain, you know, we don't really want to court maybe hard out conservatives, but we don't start off when we do analysis from a left-leaning place. Like, it always starts off from a pretty fair place.
Yeah.
Which I've even noticed.
I mean, if there's something I'm trying to bridge here, it's like, it's the left and the technocratic sort of public policy oriented people. Because yeah. that is a gap that I would like to close. And,
of course.
But like, there's a lot of, you know, technocrat public policy people who skew conservative, and that's fine. Listen to the show, make up your mind. But I mean, you're just not the key demographic. So like, if I'm not pandering to you, there's a reason why, you know? So I just wanted to clear the air, because this was like, I get hate mail every once in a while. Anybody in public, like the bigger name you are, the more hate mail you get. Like, and so it's almost like a seal of approval in some weird way. But most of it I just brush off. But this one like annoyed me, so I just wanted to put it out there.
We'll specifically cut this, we'll edit it, we'll put subtitles and post it on Twitter, just, you know, so he can say it.
This is actually a good one to do as a audiogram. Yeah, the second quick hit is there was an article that came out in Foreign Policy a few days ago, a week ago, but it missed the cycle of the last episode. There's this guy, James Crabtree, who's based out of Singapore, I think. And he wrote this terrible piece about Biden's credibility problem in Asia. And it's just like the hawky hawk, Asian conservative slanted piece. There's like almost nothing good about it. The idea that you're going to like call out Biden as having a credibility problem in Asia, A, when he's not president yet, B, when he hasn't said much about Asia yet, and giant fucking C, that Trump is the point of comparison here, who has no credibility whatsoever. And like poll after poll comes out of Asian fucking countries showing that they have, we're in the gutter in terms of public opinion in Asia about the US. And you have even close allies hedging against the U.S. This could not be more ridiculous of a comparison. And professor at University of Chicago saw this piece and he just tweeted out, "My concern about almost 200,000 dead Americans and a whole lot of other Trump-related issues far outweighs my interest in satisfying the pro-Trump desires of some foreign elites." Which is basically what this guy was arguing in Foreign Policy. It's like, look, there are some elite Mandarins in Singapore, definitely in Japan, definitely in Taiwan, who they like what Trump is doing, starting a clash of civilizations, that he's taking it to China, you know? And that is a wildly minority opinion. But this guy is representing it like it's the mean opinion or the mainstream opinion. And it's just so fucking not. I know, because I deal with these countries. I talk to people. Like, also, there's this opinion polling, which stands as like the most objective measure we can have. All of it suggests that like favoring American militarism in Asia is not a majority opinion. But even if it was, there's two issues here. One is like, when you do this militarist stuff, you're increasing risks of conflict. That's a problem in itself, regardless of whether it's popular. So like, you need to manage the security competition thing so it doesn't blow up. You can't just do high risk national security stuff because it's popular. And to be clear, once again, it's not fucking popular. But then also what Paul Staniland, this University of Chicago professor, is bringing up is like, look, even if it was super popular, even if it was the militarist stuff wasn't dangerous, the metric that Biden should care about is the fucking massive body count that Trump is accumulating at home. Who cares about fucking Asia when you can't keep the country together? There's no country to represent abroad when it's cannibalizing itself on the inside like this because of bad public policy. So it's like the Paul Staniland message puts it all into perspective. Ultimately, I just want to stress that Biden does not and cannot have a credibility problem in Asia at this point. If he does eventually, we can deal with that when it comes, but I don't think he will. And the most important thing is, like, if Biden was not seen as credible or resolute or believable with commitments in Asia, what would be the consequence of that? Like, the so what here is quite elusive. So some guys in Singapore think that, Biden is not tough on China. What's the consequence of that? Does that mean Singapore is going to bandwagon with China? I don't think so. This is an artificial frame, an artificial narrative. But even if it was true, where does that leave us? Who cares? I don't know. I'm not even going to link to the piece. It's just, I wanted to be clear. Biden does not have a credibility problem in Asia. And even if he did, it wouldn't matter at this point.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, for Prediction Market this week, question one, will any other NGOs or coalitions publicly denounce Belarus's President Lukashenko before November? And this is following the EU stating that they don't recognize Lukashenko as a legitimate president and that the results from the August 9th vote are fraudulent.
So I think other, I mean, NGOs, coalitions, and blocs is quite a broad question. But I think the answer is yes, in general. The EU saying that they're not going to recognize Lukashenko's presidency because it's fraudulent, because there's corruption here, that's significant. And it's kind of an impressive, like I think I said before, how the EU handles dictatorships in its ranks. And most recently, Belarus is a measure of its own future, you know? And so the fact that they're considering sanctions and that rhetorically they're not going to legitimate this election, I don't know, that's not a trivial thing. I think it's a good thing. And certainly the liberal foot soldiers of various NGOs around Europe and the global north are going to echo this too, I think. It does raise interesting questions, though, like, if Trump pulls election stunts and it's obvious for all to see, which it already is, does that mean the rest of the world won't recognize the U.S. presidency? Because, like, by this same reasoning, they should not if he ends up becoming a monarch or declaring himself a dictator or suspending the elections. If it's done for fraudulent reasons and everybody can see that, then it means that, like, the rest of the world might not treat the executive branch in the U.S. as legitimate, which is, I don't know, fucking galaxy. Like, that makes you think all kinds of things.
Well, it's interesting that you mention the conversation we had previously, because it was actually in relation to Hungary, man. And I actually wanted to mention that, because you said the EU sort of making its own future here with how they recognize dictators. Yeah. And I think they might have learned their lesson with Hungary, because they're treating Belarus with a hell of a lot harder of a hand than they ever did Viktor Orban.
Yeah.
In Hungary. So, which is good. Maybe they learned their lesson, or maybe they just listened to the podcast. Either way.
Yeah. Probably both. Yeah.
Question two. Will the recent arms sales surge by the United States and Asia continue through to the new year? And this is following a story from Reuters showing that the United States plans to push arms sales to Taiwan, which includes cruise missiles, drones, mines, and seven major weapon systems.
Yeah, so the spigot on arms sales to Taiwan has opened up in a big way, and it really is to stick a thumb in the eye of China. There is principled reason to support Taiwan as a consolidated democracy, but the people who are supporting Taiwan right now, by and large, especially in Washington, they were more or less with Taiwan way before Taiwan was a democracy. So, like, the fact I think we should be supporting Taiwan right now, but I think that the way people are supporting Taiwan right now has nothing to do with the fact that it's like democracy versus autocracy. I think it's one, interest group politics, which have been there forever. And then two, it's Taiwan as an object in Sino-US competition. And that is something that Taiwan seem to be loving it, that like they're kind of benefiting from more American attention and definitely more arms sales because of how it plays out in Sino-US competition. But I feel like that's dangerous because not smart. Like, if I was the Taiwans, I would not want to be a pawn in a game against China, because the logic can lead to very unfavorable outcomes for Taiwan. Real quick, not just in the sense of like accidentally goading China into, you know, taking actions against Taiwan, but if the reason why we support Taiwan is anti-China, then if Washington stops being anti-China or that fades away, so too will support for Taiwan fade away. And so like, you don't, if you're Taiwan, you don't want that to be the reason why you are getting more love from America. And I feel like they're not thinking two steps ahead here. They're just thinking about the present moment and like lavishing the attention, feeling like we're closer than ever. And I don't know. It's just not strategic.
All right. For question three, will the United Kingdom follow through with their desire to fund and facilitate the building of 8 large missile boats for the Ukrainian military before December?
I sure hope so. For the sake of the prediction, I would say yes. It would be a great, I feel like for Ukraine, it's a very smart move to try and, I don't know if entangle is the right word, but to like bring the UK into your political orbit or whatever, like to thicken those ties. And this would be a non-trivial way of doing that. Partly because Ukraine itself, it's been very dependent on the United States to like rebuff Russia. But it's also very clear that Ukraine has become a political football in U.S. politics. And so it makes sense to try and diversify. And so this could be one way of doing that.
It seems the UK at the moment is throwing away all their other friends with this shoddy Brexit deal. And now they're going to the other countries that also can't get into the EU. And it's a weird block. It's going to be a weird, the Ukrainian-English block.
Yeah.
Might take over Europe, who knows? Well, there's Prediction Market.
All right.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
Okay, so for Stay Off Twitter, man, so this is the first time I think that I'm doing one that's not a person. The news website India Today decided to go on Twitter and troll China's Global Times, which is a mouthpiece for the CCP. And so India Today says, "Dear Global Times, welcome to the world of satire. Our democracy allows it. We've been telling you this for a while now, that today's India is not the India of the 1960s. Anyway, happy some of you could watch the video, even if through VPN, winking emoji, and thanks for amplifying it," which is so fucking sick. But like, they're responding to the Global Times posted on Twitter this cartoonish video, a politoon, which the phrase I had not heard before, a political cartoon video, yeah, that India Today produced, showing Modi shooting enemies and representing Chinese apps in the targets. And so Global Times released the video, or shared the video on Twitter, condemning it because it's like Indian bravado against China and it's cartoony and funny and condescending toward China. And so Global Times was like, "Wah, wah, wah, Tian Sha." And India Today responded by being like, "Welcome to the world of satire." Also throwing mad shade at the dystopian autocracy that is China. So I appreciated that.
Funny we mentioned India Today, because I actually cited them in one of my prediction market predictions, and I was told that I can't use it because they're probably fraudulent.
Well, they got a blue check on Twitter, so they're legit. Second tweet is from John Lee, and he has a YouTube channel that I think recently launched. I haven't looked at it yet, but he says some funny shit on Twitter. He's a Korean-American. I don't know what he is. He's Asian. But that sounded racist, nice. But it's not. So
of all the ways you could have handled that one, man.
In fact, that's an interesting segue to this tweet, because there was this breaking story about a Chinese company that had been scraping the internet to build profiles of influential people around the world that they could compromise, or that it's this huge data breach kind of thing. But most of it was from public sources. And what they were doing was building profiles on people who they would be able to influence in the future. And in that database, they had, thousands of Australians, thousands of Americans. I think they had like 800 Kiwis or something. But they also categorized a certain percentage of these people as being compromised. And like, we don't know what that means precisely, but presumably it means that they have dirt on those people, or that those people can be blackmailed, which is a big deal. And in the article that an Australian newspaper released about it, they interviewed some person who is a Five Eyes intelligence officer, not named. And he says, the this is fucking nutty. The East Asian mind and the Western mind are fundamentally different in the way they think. Western thought is based on causality. East Asian thinking is like a spider's web. And so,
feels like a lot of Asian thinking on this podcast.
Yeah.
Very spider's web vibe.
We're the spider.
There's no linear thought here.
Yeah. And so Ankit Panda was on the pod, a buddy. He was like, I see we have some very serious analysis here. And then obviously, because it's a fucking pseudo-racist joke. And then John Lee comes in and goes, all right, which one of you fellow Asian fucks forgot to share this memo with me? We're all on the same fucking team. It would have been awfully nice if we could get some fucking coordination around here. I've been thinking based on causality this whole goddamn time.
That's so good.
Golly, such a fucking legend.
So funny, man. Comedy in 280 characters. Yes. So like, great way to throw shade at the like bizarro unintended racism on display here. So shout out to John Lee.
Is that a real, that there are like two distinct ways of thinking, like Western and East Asian?
There are some people who make that kind of like caricatured claim. There are versions of that claim that are narrower, that are more plausible. Like when you compare strategy games, like Go and chess are just like wildly different logics, you know, but the notion of like an East Asian mind or a Western mind, it takes it too far, like way too far. Yeah. And to like use that as your prism through which to make sense of this China scraping database compromise thing. It's just fucking weird that if that's where your head is at, as an intel officer who's looking at China, I think you're going to fuck it up. That's my concern.
It's got some gnarly implications too. Yeah. If you think like people think innately because of the culture they're born or the way they're born.
And then what about the Hapas? Like what about somebody who's half fucking Asian and half, you know, Western, quote unquote. I don't even know what the fuck Western means anymore. But
yeah, wow, shit.
You have to self-select, like you get to age 12 or something, you have to go to a training camp to choose whether or not you take your Western mind to your Eastern mind.
All right, well, from now on, I've been doing causality mind, but now on, it's going to be spider web. I'm spider mind.
This is Dan's origin story as a superhero.
Spider mind.
How reflective, this guy you said was a Five Eyes officer, like this intelligence officer. Do you think his view is like reflective of, you know, this combined agency agreement? I don't know what to say. Like, is it just like this one dude probably?
Who the fuck knows? I don't even know. It was ridiculous. Sure. So that news story that had his quote in it about fucking Eastern mind, Western mind, they pulled out that quote after seeing the story getting trolled on Twitter. So like, it was very distracting from the main message, which is like, hey guys, China's building a global database to build fucking compromise on all of us who have any political influence in the world. And so like that should have been the main story. Wow. And instead everybody was dunking on this guy who was like structurally racist and didn't know it.
Oh, that's so unfortunate.
Yeah. So they pulled that part. They pulled that. You can't even, if you go back and find the story, the quote's not in there anymore, but people did screen captures.
At that point, you almost just got to leave it in there because it looks worse when you delete it.
I know. Like, you know, you fucked up. Yeah.
Yeah.
This one's from Andreas Fulda, who's a senior fellow at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute. So he's got this pretty slick thread that talks about why it's taking so long for the German government to abandon its failed China policy of change through trade. So, Fulda explains, when it comes to China, the German government has largely engaged in foreign trade promotion. However, because it has let its private sector take the lead, Germany has gone about things through a highly corporatist approach. meaning that it makes like for policy change through legislative means that much harder. And then Volta says that this has led to corporate lobbyists hyping up the significance of the Chinese market for Germany's traditionally export-oriented economy for decades. He also offers ways in which Germany's outdated China policy can change, which is why I'd recommend checking the entire thread out. But I didn't even realize this was a thing that was happening and wanted to flag it down just to get your thoughts on them.
Yeah, so this is not exactly like the hot take dunking on somebody. It's much, there's nothing funny about it. It's like Germany is basically selling out its own interests by allowing the corporate world to drive its China policy on something like so strategically important to continue to like inhabit a 1990s mindset. Very dangerous, very high risk. It reminds me of the thread is quite long and good, and it cites a bunch of evidence that is, if this is your bag, it's worth checking out. But it reminds me of Norway in Netflix's Occupied show, like yeah. Where their whole, and I teach this in one of my strategy courses as a fictional case study. Because it's very representative of like how the EU thought and how small Western countries think about foreign policy and geopolitics up until sort of this like the Trump era. But not everybody has divested of this old mindset yet. And so even there are some changes even in New Zealand, but New Zealand is like so hardcore in this direction too, where Germany is, where it's like you locked yourself in. Through social ties, through inter-elite ties, through business arrangements, through trade dependency and investment dependency, you've created this like very thick, dense pattern with China that makes you like fairly vulnerable. You're by definition, if you're outsourcing your foreign policy to the private sector on something so important, you're taking on a lot of risks, and chances are you're not even adequately self-aware about it. And that's super fucking, there's no limit to the danger of that because you're just not playing the game. Like you're not with it. And so the fact that like Germany is doing this and it's basically like the leader of the European Union, it's a big fucking problem. You know, it is the scenario that leads you to possibly a Netflix occupied alternative future.
Just like a spinoff or like completely like alternate universe. You really like that show, man. It was really good, actually. I ended up binge watching all the seasons just because it was actually really good.
It's super good. The thing that I loved about it was that it was incredibly realistic about EU politics and about liberal foreign policy, like a non-realist foreign policy, and showing how like the liberal foreign policy can actually fuck you over. It was these decisions about like green energy and climate politics and economic interdependence that ended up making Norway fucking militarily occupied by Russia. And when you just like say that and you haven't seen the show, it's like, well, how could that possibly be the case? But then you see the show and it's totally plausible. It makes a lot of sense. And it's like, fuck, not only does it make sense, it's like, dude, if I'm a small, like liberal country, I am single-mindedly obsessed about avoiding that alternative future. Like, regardless of how likely it is, that's something you have to like existentially guard against. And so, yeah, I use it because it's like, you know, we're in New Zealand and I can't think of a better example or analog.
Yeah. No, it's legit. So my second tweet of the week comes from Nicholas Miller, who's an assistant professor of government over at Dartmouth. So much bullshit has been happening this week. But one that Miller grabs onto was the comments from Pompeo, where he claimed that, and I quote, "We've made life more difficult for the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regime. We'll continue to put pressure on them. President Trump has made clear Iran will never have a nuclear weapon." To which Miller tweets, "Your regular reminder that the Trump administration's goal was to zero out Iran's enriched uranium stockpile, and instead they've increased it tenfold." Like, I mean, what else can you say? Holy shit, yeah.
So first of all, I just have to dunk a little bit on you for saying Dartmouth, because it's Dartmouth.
Oh, it's stupid.
It's a baby dunk. Because Nick will hear this and he'll be like, Dartmouth? What the fuck? So like, let's just be clear, Dartmouth. it's neither here nor there. But the tweet is obviously fantastic. And this is why strategy matters. This is why theory matters, right? So like, no matter how stupid and crude you are, you look out onto the world and there are things you want to achieve. It doesn't matter if you're a fucking knuckle dragger or not. You want to achieve, you want to realize certain things. The Trump administration wants to realize the status quo with Iran not having nuclear weapons. And so the way that they go about preserving that status quo is to pile pressure and sanctions on them and assassinate military leaders and do gunboat diplomacy and walk away from the nuclear deal that was keeping them from going nuclear, because that's what it was. That's a fucking nuclear deal. And so like the Trump administration is doing all of these things that any sane person, let alone an IR scholar, can see are dramatically more likely to cause Iran to go nuclear. And so what is your theory of the case here? What's the strategy that says by squeezing Iran and walking away from an arms control deal and killing its leaders, that will preserve the status quo with Iran? Like, what kind of through the looking glass John Bolton shit is that? It doesn't make any fucking sense. It doesn't make it's yeah. The opposite of fucking sanity. Nick Miller is pointing to the evidence that proves what the theory would have told us, which is that this is bad fucking strategy. It's not realistic. It's not coherent. It's based on a very bad assessment of Iran, but of just of any actors. Like the idea that you're going to squeeze people the way that the U.S. squeezes Iran the last 4 years, and that will somehow preserve the status quo instead of disrupt it, it doesn't make any sense. It's like gaslighting through foreign policy, but where the stakes are bad guys go nuclear. So like, this is a huge fucking problem. And then war, you know, Nick is keeping it sane, which means calling out the insanity of Pompeo. So shout out.
Yeah.
You know, that was perfect analysis, man, but I can't let this continue. It's spelt Dartmouth.
No, but not even
Dartmouth. Hey, what else is that supposed to mean?
Of all people in the world to claim that you pronounce things the way they're spelled, for Kiwis to say that, I have a kid in a Kiwi school. They don't pronounce R's. And so when he reads words, he's like, you guys say R, but they say ah. And it's like, what? It's confusing as hell. This is.
Look, our A's are E's, our O's are U's, our I's are A's, and we're just real confused. So, like, when you guys rip us out, we've got to fight back.
I think that's quite rich.
I'm not fucking dying on this. Sorry, bro.
All right. Sorry, Nick, if you took this as throwing shade at your Ivy League school.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
Sweet. So this week we'll dive into a piece from Inkslick Media by Jessica Slate, Ward Wilson, and Derek Johnson called There's Nothing Magical About Nuclear Weapons. And this is a response piece. It's a hit back at a piece in the Washington Post from last week by, and then you might have to jump in here with the pronunciation, David von Trail.
Oh, dude, I don't know.
Yeah, it's very general.
Names are different. Names are like all bets are off.
But basically what David writes in the Washington Post, in the words of these authors, is he asks us to resign ourselves to living under the shadow of nuclear weapons. This idea that they're a necessary evil to maintaining a mythical nuclear peace. And this article really comprehensively goes through and challenges that assertion. And it sets out each of the kind of key arguments that David makes. Firstly, this idea that nuclear weapons will always be with us, and so we have to resolve ourselves to them, which, as they really rightly point out, is an assertion, not an argument. And like every other piece of technology that's ever been invented, one of two things will eventually happen. one, something better will come along, or two, people will realize that it wasn't very useful technology and it will fall out of existence. Secondly, they point to his argument that everyone wants them, that the United States has to remain the world's policeman, or otherwise other nations will feel obligated to create their own nuclear umbrellas. And it's true that some states really desperately want nukes, right? Pakistan's Prime Minister Ali Bhutto once famously said that Pakistanis wanted nukes so bad they would be willing to eat grass to get them. But it's worth remembering, as these authors point out, that North Korea desperately wanted nuclear weapons and got nuclear weapons, and it's probably one of the poorest states in the world. And there are hundreds of states which haven't done that. If North Korea could, anyone could, and yet they don't. And almost no one argues for unilateral disarmament anyway. Advocates understand that nuclear disarmament is a global endeavor, they say, that the world has to come down together from the brink. Then they point to this argument that nuclear weapons rendered all-out war obsolete. And it's true that no rational person would ever voluntarily start a nuclear war, but humans aren't rational. What if the warning that a national leader receives is false? What if a training tape was confused as a real launch? What if a computer malfunction showed an incoming attack? Those are false alarms that have happened over history, and that could really have led us to the brink. Yeah. Ronald Reagan wrote in his memoirs that 6 minutes to decide how to respond to a blip on a radar scope and decide whether to unleash Armageddon. How could anyone apply reason at a time like that? The argument of nuclear elimination, they write, is as compelling as human nature and as clear as the logic of three short sentences. First, all human beings are fallible and everyone makes mistakes, from the lowest soldier to the commander-in-chief. Second, human beings are involved in every aspect of nuclear deterrence, from issuing threats to interpreting and evaluating them to deciding how to respond. And third, if human beings are prone to folly, and we are, and if human beings are involved in nuclear deterrence, and we are, then nuclear deterrence is by its very nature flawed and will fail. Global Zero, the campaign for eliminating nuclear weapons, is, in their words, an antidote, actionable hope. And I think it's a really useful piece because it is true that, you know, mutually assured destruction and the logic of nuclear weapons is an article of faith among realists around the world. And I don't think the assumption that it's borne out by logic is as safe as people assume. But I mean, what did you think of it, Ben?
Yeah, so I like, in the main, I liked the piece. And for what the piece is trying to do, I thought it was very good. So Global Zero, one of its most valuable functions, and one of the functions of this piece, is to not delegitimize nukes, but kind of. It's to keep the Overton window, or to shift the Overton window in favor of disarmament, right? Against sort of like nuclear militarism, for lack of a better phrase. And so, like, you have to stigmatize these things. And so keeping that drumbeat going is important. And this is where the activist and the NGO community has been like the most useful on this issue. The pushback against the David von Drehl, whatever you say, piece is good. That's part of that. Like, that's how you keep doing your Overton window work. And the logical claim that they're making is, it harkens back to the proliferation debate, Sagan-Waltz thing that I talked about a few episodes ago, like proliferation optimism versus pessimism. The logic of mutual deterrence makes sense. Nukes as stability makes sense, generally speaking, or all else being equal. The problem is that the caveat of all else being equal, or the caveat of like generally speaking as opposed to 100% of the time, that margin or that difference is nuclear use. It's nuclear war. And so this is why policymakers, like we talked about before, they adopt implicitly the Scott Sagan view here. It's the proliferation pessimist view as driving policy, because you're concerned about the risk of use. You're not concerned about the probability of success of stability. A 1% chance of nuclear Armageddon is too high. Like your concern should be like, how can we buy down that risk? It's not, oh, we should be comfortable living with that risk and indefinitely. And so the idea that like they phrase it as like pushing back on the claim that all out war is obsolete. All out war is not obsolete because it could happen. That is, I think, valid. I think that's logical. I think that's a good door to push back, to push open, or like that's a good claim to like make. And it's one of the reasons why moving toward disarmament to the extent that you can is important. So like there's a moral and a strategic claim that's valuable here. If I have issues with this piece, one, it's that this piece is, as with much of the like activist type analysis, it's Overton window work, which is necessary. It's generally not sufficient, right? It's super important, but there has to be more. And that's the whole like bridging to the technocrat thing. This kind of piece is just not going to, it doesn't engage the actual concerns that people who do nuclear policy that I know, or like when I was in the fucking Obama administration, this piece wouldn't have given me anything to work with to make different kinds of arguments about nuclear policy. The fact that they talk about how like deterrence has failed many times with nuclear weapons, that's kind of like a semantic, it sounds like a semantic difference, but it's a big deal. The nuclear scholars, the nuclear literature by and large does not claim that nuclear deterrence has never failed. It claims that nuclear deterrence has always succeeded in deterring other nukes. So conflict still, we all know that the Kargil war happened between two nuclear states. We all know that South Korea, given its opportunity, would have attacked a nuclear North Korea in 2010 if we didn't hold them back. There are all these examples of non-nuclear states being willing to attack nuclear states. So like nukes can be in the picture and conflict can still happen. But one of the things that we learned from the deterrence literature, like there's three or four waves of it. The third wave of deterrence theory that came out in the 70s and 80s, the bumper sticker was basically that nukes are only good for deterring other nukes. And that claim is consistent with what they're arguing here about deterrence fails, because they're talking about not deterrence of other nukes, but they're talking about deterrence of other things, deterrence of aggression, deterrence of conflict. The claim they're making here and the mindset of the nuclear scholar or the nuclear practitioner, it's not incompatible. Almost saying similar things, but with different valence or different attitude attached to it. And so that's like slightly problematic. The main thing, like zooming out, what I really would love to see is the kinds of analysis that take this to the next step in two ways. One is like, okay, what is the actual plausible strategy to get toward disarmament, the strategy that you can sell, right? Like, how do you convince people who are able to make these decisions? Because people who don't have nukes, by and large, are already convinced. But it's the countries that have nukes that need to be convinced, and they're the ones who don't sign on to the disarmament treaty, right? They're the ones who refuse to actually give up nuclear weapons. It's the ones who have them. So there's a problem. There's a problem there that needs a sellable strategy. Right, we're still sort of waiting for that. It's not that activists don't have a strategy; it's that the strategy doesn't dislodge the core of the problem, which is these states who still possess nukes, including the U.S. And then the other thing is, like, this argument here is not very much in conversation with the people who do the Wizards of Armageddon stuff, right? This doesn't actually address the narrow sort of analytical concerns about deterrence, and it could, or like stability or risk. And there are arguments to be had in that space. There is a continuous conversation that is possible between activists whose bias is toward disarmament and practitioners whose bias is toward, like, I don't know, 1% doctrine thinking or like preemptive war. And we need the Overton window stuff can make a difference. Like in the 80s with Reagan, the global disarmament movement kept pressure on governments. It encouraged Reagan and Gorbachev to move toward arms control, right? But it also didn't stop the nuclear war scares of Abel Archer in 1983 and all of that stuff. There's got to be like more direct engagement with the people who think that low-yield nukes, for example, makes sense. So like we're in, one of the problems we have right now is that everybody who deals with nuclear weapons in the national security community, and especially in the Trump administration, they all have like undertaken this great forgetting about the deterrence literature. They are not engaged at all with the third wave of deterrence literature. They've moved on, or they've like looked past it to look to older traditions when nukes were new. They have beliefs formed about the value of nuclear superiority, nuclear coercion, escalation dominance, that are like real convictions, but the logic is shaky and there's not a lot of evidence for it. And there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. And that's what the third wave of deterrence literature was. It was a whole bunch of case studies that proved the logic that leads you to chase nuclear superiority, to arms race, to pursue low yield nuclear weapons. That logic is shaky and largely counterproductive in practice, high risk too. And so recalling those traditions are a way, which involves theory, is a way of making the arguments that you need to push back on these psychopaths right now. It, in some sense, it's like you defer on the question of disarmament to a later day, or you reserve that for the Overton window type claims. But then there also has to be a line of effort that directly deconstructs this low-yield nuke logic stuff, the need for the triad. And that requires engaging using the lexicon and the shibboleths and the reasoning, like getting expertise in that and then like deploying it. And so you need people basically who work security studies but who are sympathetic with the activist mindset or the disarmament community, you know. This is not dunking on the piece in any way. Like, I liked the piece a lot. It's like, that's where I want things to go next, you know. So this is like a good baseline.
Yeah, totally. And we can't expect all pieces to be all things. But I think that's 100% a really good, just kind of visioning of where to go next.
Yeah.
Although I hate myself for having used the word visioning now.
Yeah, you're fired. All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
For Ask Me Anything this week, we have four questions. The first one is from an anonymous PhD student at MIT. What do you think about taking money from the Koch brothers? It funds a program at my university. They say, but they're kind of evil. I think they're purely evil, but what do you think?
Yeah, so the Koch brothers are totally a blight on humanity. They're evil. I don't know if you should take their money though. Like, so a few years ago, I found out that a lot of security studies programs and IR programs at the most prestigious schools in the U.S. are being bankrolled by the Koch brothers, and the Koch brothers are like, deconstructing the government and private prisons, and like, it's, they're fucking bad news in so many ways, rigging politics at the local level and the state level. Like, it's so bad. But IR and security studies is like a cash strapped field. Like, there's not a lot of money going around. And so like, if you want people to know about the world, and to be able to manage policy responsibly, like, you need to get money from somewhere, and like, you wouldn't want it from the devil, but it's better than nothing, right? So like, I don't know if that's actually true or not. What I do know is that the Koch brothers are interested in restraint in foreign policy, which at the time when I found out about Koch funding of security studies several years ago, I was very like, these motherfuckers. It was the unipolar moment still, so like, restraint was stupid, or like, it was like a not well substantiated line of argument. I and many others have like completely changed our attitude about restraint after Trump became president. There's a lot of value in the intellectual diversity of having people who are wanting to make more arguments about restraining militarism and foreign policy. That's useful to have in the conversation, and that slides out of the conversation among elites if there is not Koch money to fund it. Even the Quincy Institute that we've talked about on the podcast many times, it's a restraint think tank for statecraft. They're funded partly by, I think, George Soros and partly by the Koch brothers. So that's almost like you can use your opinions about Quincy as a proxy for your opinions about the Koch brother money. Like, do you take money from the devil to do something good with it? Like, that's kind of the philosophical question at issue here.
Like, if the Koch brothers lose money and we gain effective policy that goes against their worldview, then why not take their money?
If you're letting them put their thumb on the scale by giving money, then that's a problem. But, like, there's kind of like a guerrilla warfare Viet Cong mindset here. It's like, you take the weapons of the enemy and use them against them, you know? The weapon here is money. And so, like, if you can weaponize the enemy's money to, you know, bolster causes that the enemy opposes, like, isn't that a good... It's almost a question of, like, idealist versus real politic thinking about, you know, your own choices.
Okay, so the third question this week is from Bilbo Swaggins. I have heard you make a distinction between progressive foreign policy and Marxist foreign policy. Where is the distinction in your opinion?
This is an interesting question. There was a long-form piece in Foreign Policy back when Bernie Sanders was the leading contender for the presidential nomination. And the piece was, I think it was literally called like a socialist, what does a socialist foreign policy look like? And it was a good basis to compare to the various arguments that have been made, including by me, about what a progressive foreign policy looks like. And so one of the things that confuses this issue is that a lot of Marxists have tried to claim progressivism. They are progressive foreign policy. And it's like, well, that's just switching the labels. Like, you're pulling a switcheroo. There is, I've said before, working on a book about this, there's like a plurality or a diversity of thought within the progressive movement about foreign policy issues. So there are areas of convergence and there are areas of cleavage. And one of the things that I see, the core thing that I see that's different between a Marxist foreign policy or a socialist foreign policy, let's say, and a progressive foreign policy, because there are lots of overlaps, is that a socialist foreign policy is inherently anti-capital. So like it's trying to deconstruct basically the liberal international order, if you want to think of it like that. International financial institutions, World Bank, WTO, obviously, IMF, anything that is supporting or promoting economic interdependence or capitalism becomes the overarching, the priority target in a socialist foreign policy. There are other things, like there are overlaps on climate change. There's overlaps on like anti-imperialism, you know, inequality, obviously, there's convergences. But progressive internationalism in the style of like Dan Nexon or, you know, Elizabeth Warren or even Bernie, they're not trying to transcend capitalism. They're trying to like work within it, basically. And this issue gets confused even more because there's a transnational network now called Progressive International, and it works with the Sanders Institute. That's like a Bernie-ish think tank.
And hijacked their names with internationals.
Yeah. So like, but it's it's called the Progressive International, as in Communist International, but its agenda is actually, the substance of it is like indistinguishable from what would be like Socialist International or Communist International. They specifically say on their About Us site that they are aiming to create a post-capitalist world. As far as I know, it's only the Marxists and anarchists who have that ambition. And like, that's the thing that your strategy is aimed toward. And like progressive foreign policy generally is not aiming at that at all. And many, many progressives work within the liberal tradition still. And so like there, that's like, I think the main cleavage.
The distinctions, some of the distinctions I think are correct that you made, Van. This isn't the arena to have this intense theoretical discussion, but I think the goals are ultimately the same. We just have different ways of getting to those goals in that regard. Like, I know that's a very vanilla statement. I believe there's sort of an original sin that we've all got to deal with in this regard, which is capital, whereas the progressive wing don't really see that as the sin that I see it as.
Well, it's quite possible that actually an expert on social democracy, Sherry Berman, I think at Harvard, she was asked, what's the difference between, like, you know, socialism and social democracy? And because she wrote the book about it in like 1930s Europe. And she's like, at the level of agendas, they won't necessarily look different. They could look, it's possible to have their agendas look 100% the same, but their vision or what it is that they're like ultimately imagining that they're working toward is different. And so like, but that doesn't, those end goals don't necessarily, or like the way your worldview does not necessarily translate into a different agenda, I guess.
So the fourth question, which was added in while we were recording, is from John Galt. How do you go about arguing politically with someone who does not have the same standard of evidence as you?
I try not to. So Karl Popper is, you know, the philosopher of science who, he wrote a book like The Open Society and Its Enemies and Standards of Scientific Evidence. And he was like, he's strongly associated with the liberal tradition. And he had this famous statement that's been turned into an infographic that has circulated, that's gone like viral on Twitter before. And I actually saved it. But it's an infographic that walks through his own line of reasoning about this question of tolerance. And it in some ways, it coincides with the cancel culture discussion from the last episode. But he was basically saying that, like, the paradox of liberal tolerance is that if you actually value the liberal tradition of tolerance, you can't extend that tolerance to the intolerant. You can't, because their voice functions to affect or damage the tolerance paradigm. Welcoming in the overt racist or the fascist, platforming fascists, that actually deteriorates the world of civility that you prize so much. And so if your end state is a world where people can have civil discourse, letting in the fascist on the grounds of civil discourse and openness will harm your civil discourse in the end. So you have to think about it in those ways. And like, I'm not 100% on this. Like, I haven't invested a ton of time in this, but that's basically my philosophy. Like, I absolutely believe in not talking with my MAGA parents about politics, right? I don't take trolls on the internet seriously. I don't platform fucking anybody who's remotely corrupt or like is operating in bad faith with their ideas, you know? I'm happy to not give voice or opportunity or to treat civilly people whose attitudes and philosophies are functionally anti-liberal, functionally anti-democratic. And that means embracing censorship at times, you know, fucking sue me. I don't know. Like that. So that's sort of my attitude. Like, I think Karl Popper basically got this right. Even though I'm progressive and not necessarily liberal a lot. It's an open question what I even mean by that. But in this case,
where's the distinction?
Yeah. Here is an example, you know, like I am not liberal in the sense that I'm going to tolerate the fucking fascist. I don't think Steve Bannon should get invited to the conference. You know what I mean? I have no problem with keeping him out of the tent. So in that respect, I'm not liberal, you know, but yeah. So like that, I guess that's my take on it. All right, gang. Well, that's going to do it. buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic for money. And or there's probably like a nicer way to say that, but like, whatever, you understand. And if you want to rate us on iTunes or wherever you're listening, that would be sweet too. Love it. And peace.